All right, so today is February 3rd, 2015. This is the third interview with Stephen Glass. We are here at Steenbach Memorial Library. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Steve, for sound quality purposes, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Steve Glass, G-L-A-S-S.
Great. I'm just going to slide this a little closer to you.
I can scoot closer.
So we have six or seven questions or topics that we want to get through on this final interview. A couple were things that you wanted to talk about some more. So let's start off with those. And I think you want to talk a bit more about the prescribed burning activities at the Arboretum.
Yeah, we touched on prescribed burning in the second interview, and just sort of in a technical sense and only sketchily. But I wanted to mention that I think prescribed burning is one of the great legacies of the Arboretum, in that the necessity for using prescribed management burns in prairie restoration, and then by implication other kinds of communities, was long suspected but wasn't proven scientifically until work was done at the Arboretum by Professor John Curtis and I believe his student Max Parch. And they were in the early stages of the Curtis Prairie Restoration, and this was something that had never been done before, but they had some ideas about how it should progress and what the responses of the plant community should be to the work they were doing. And they weren't getting those responses. In other words, they were troubled by residual plants from the horse pasture, like bluegrass and some other perennial plants, which they thought should gradually go away. And they weren't. So they knew that fire was often used by the Native Americans and by settlers to clear areas. And so they thought, well, maybe it has a role in an intentional way, in a managed way, under certain conditions to benefit the prairie. So they set up a series of controlled experiments and published a classic paper in 1948, which outlined the results and answered the question that, yes, the use of fire would reduce the incidence of bluegrass, which was their major problem species. And so the first prescribed management burn at the Arboretum, and maybe anywhere, probably anywhere, was conducted in 1951 on Curtis Prairie.
And is there anything more you want to say about when you came, the prescribed burning? I know we talked a bit about specific prescribed burning that you did, but I don't know if there's more that you want to talk about your role in the prescribed burning when you were in charge of it.
Yeah, I would like to. Before we get to that, I just wanted to define prescribed burning.
Okay.
And often these burns are termed controlled, but if you've ever seen a fire, you know fire is not controllable. So a prescription is written that details under what conditions a burn will be conducted and under what conditions it won't be conducted. And basically those prescriptions deal essentially with weather conditions and are used to determine when you can burn so that you can predict the behavior of the fire. So you want to start it when you want to start it, and you want to stop it where and when you want to stop it. And you do that through using weather conditions that will give you the sort of behavior you're looking for, plus you use a lot of water. A lot of water, a lot of people, and grass and pavement and water bodies also help you manage it. And you can conduct prescribed burns that are either for management purposes or for research purposes. And the research might be designed to answer some particular question about how a plant community operates, or might also just be used to prepare a research site. And we did those at the Arboretum, especially after Joy Zettler, the Alder Leopold professor, came on in about the year 2000. But mostly we did burns that were prescribed to achieve a management goal. And the planning for those burns would start about a year in advance. So the philosophy is plan for the worst and hope for the best, and you basically try and anticipate anything that could happen and any needs that you would have, from equipment to personnel to training to weather conditions. And you also prescribe the result that you want to achieve from that burn, whether it's to reduce the abundance of a pest plant or to prepare the site for planting or whatever the management goal might be. So burns had been conducted at the Arboretum since 1951, and it continued up until the time I came on in 1989. And during that time, we conducted 231 management burns on 36 different management units. These range from prairies to woods to wetlands to research plots. And just to show you how dicey the whole thing is, during that time we had an average number of burnable days. Those are days that met our site and weather prescriptions, of almost 7.5 a year. And this is a period stretching from, say, the middle of March to the middle of May. So it's not very many. But we did manage to burn an average of 9.6, or conduct an average of 9.6 burns a year, with a low of 1 in the year 2011 and a high of 13 in the year 2004.
So that spreadsheet you're looking at, a printout of a spreadsheet that talks about fire from the first one in 51 through the fires that you were involved in before you retired?
No, there is a spreadsheet for that. I don't have that with me, but this is a spreadsheet that shows the prescribed management research burns from 1988, that's the year before I came, through 2011. Okay. That was the last year that I was in charge of burning. Okay. And I have to say, it's one of the most scary and thrilling things that most people will ever do, and that I certainly ever did. And as I said, you engage in a lot of planning and coordination and try and find every reason you can to prevent trouble and to say no. And I can remember that the usual feeling was that you would have your plan, have your prescription, you'd coordinate with the crew, you'd do a walkthrough like we talked about the last time. Mm-hmm. Everybody's comfortable with the weather and how the fire's behaving, and you do a test fire just to confirm your observations, and they light the match and the fire starts off, and about 10 minutes later you think, what was I thinking? Why did we do this? Because the fire, as I say, it's not controlled. It takes off, it goes. Mm-hmm. And but it always went according to how we wanted it to behave. And so I'm proud of that. As I mentioned last time, we had no incidents of personal injury or property damage. Although, as I also mentioned, there were some times that came close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you want to move on to the multiple identities, or do you want to talk more about anything more you want to say about the burns?
Well, but I'll, just a few more things about the burns. I had some book learning on prescribed fire before I started. I had the opportunity to learn from the crew leader at the time, who was Larry Ring, and he really had a feel for conducting a prescribed burn. So I learned a lot from him. And then really learned a lot about the theory and the practice of writing prescriptions and managing burns from Nancy Breaker, Hannah Spall, and Tom Aronov of the TNC. They conducted a number of burn courses and were great resources for I guess adopting a good frame of mind for conducting a burn. Mm-hmm. And Tom Zellmer from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then all the staff and students that we work with on the burns, we couldn't have done it without those folks, of course. And so I think one of the legacies of the Arboretum, which I'm guessing, since it started in 51 and developed the notion of prescribed management burns, has the longest running program anywhere of prescribed management burns and research burns up through the year 2014. So I think that's an important legacy, and I'm proud of the role that I played in that for 23 years. Mm-hmm. So I think that covers the prescribed management.
Okay. So the other topic that you wanted to have some space to talk more about was the last interview you talked about what you saw as the multiple identities or publics of the Arboretum. So I want to give you some space to talk some more about that.
Yeah, I think as we talked in perhaps in both interviews, Dave Egan and I did some thinking about the multiple identities or aspirations internal to the Arboretum. These are the things that staff colleagues wanted to do that weren't necessarily, in our view, directly related to managing prairies and conducting restoration research. And then the identities and aspirations imposed on the Arboretum from outside, from the publics. So the public had a number of hopes and desires for the Arboretum. And I think we mentioned some of those external aspirations, dog walking park, running route around Lake Ringgrau, nature walking, places to dump their lawn refuse if they happen to live next door to the Arboretum. The city's aspiration was to dump its stormwater on the Arboretum. And the Arboretum, because it's a flat open space in public land, then it's an easy corridor for roads, utility lines, anything that serves the public good. And it's an easy route. And so another colleague and myself, Maril Ingram, Marillingram. She was the editor of the journal that Dave edited after Dave left at the Arboretum. And so I'll come back to the thinking that Maril and I had about this public open space. But Dave and I were thinking about these multiple internal aspirations and identities that were represented, you know, by the talented, bright, energetic staff colleagues that we had. And because there wasn't strong leadership at the top that enforced, you know, the strategic vision of being a restoration ecology research center, then all of these other interests and identities flourished. And they ranged from, you know, wanting the Arboretum to be a nature center, or wanting the Arboretum to be a long-term ecological research station, or wanting the Arboretum to be an urban ecology research center, or wanting the Arboretum to be a living history museum and petting zoo like Old World Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Or wanting the Arboretum to just host recreational events. And Dave and I came up with a dozen or more. Different scenarios that were represented by one or more staff members as their aspirations of what the Arboretum should be. And we sort of came up with this as a think piece in the midst of strategic planning and in the year 2000 and then later in 2004. And our hope was that the Arboretum leadership would, you know, settle on something, one thing, or maybe two things, and excel at those, rather than trying to do this dozen or more activities, none of which could succeed, you know, or achieve excellence simply because there were no resources. And if anyone's been around the university for a time knows that budgets have shrunk and salaries haven't risen and staff cuts have come and gone. And so we proposed this little scenario planning. In our aspiration was that Arboretum would pick one or two and go with it, but didn't happen. So and just to follow up on the comment I made about Murrell Ingram and myself, we started thinking about the Arboretum as this flat, open public land in the midst of a city, and realized that what the Arboretum was doing was negotiating everything it did. We had to negotiate with let's talk about prescribed fire. We had to negotiate with the City of Madison to get a fire permit. We had to negotiate with the DNR over smoke permits, smoke dispersal permits. We had to negotiate with the public about which days and units we could burn so we don't impact the public. Mm-hmm. So everything the Arboretum does is, we've realized, since we're not in the midst of the fray anymore, was really a series of negotiations with public authorities about anything we did, including negotiating with the university itself over land use policy and would some portions of their Arboretum land actually be conducted for research, or would they better be used for stormwater detention ponds or highway corridors? And I'll just tie this up with prescribed burning. Yeah. And the first negotiation that the Arboretum ever did was back in 1967-68 when the DOT wanted to expand the Beltline from a narrow footprint to basically its current footprint. And that meant slicing through the Arboretum and severing 300 acres known as the Grady Tract, which is south of the Beltline. It's a great place for skiing, and it's a great oak savanna restoration site, and it's got green prairie, and it's a wonderful site. But the DOT, you know, wanted to expand the highway, and it's hard to stand in the way of DOT. And Grant Cottom, the chair of the Arboretum Committee, you know, faculty member and a noted researcher, wrote that it never was a question of would the DOT take land for the highway or not. The question was, would we get the best deal we could? So he described their dealings with the DOT as negotiation. And the reason this is important in the context of the larger picture, but specifically in the context of prescribed burning we've been talking about, when Curtis and Parch were doing their experiments, they had to have an area that wasn't burned so that they could, you know, compare the results of burned areas with an unburned area. It turns out that those control never to be burned plots now sit under a stormwater pond that was mandated by the DOT and the DNR to accommodate the expansion of the highway. So the research component of the prescribed burn program was eliminated early on. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just the situation in this urban environment where not everybody necessarily sees restoration as the ideal use of land, and you have to negotiate with others about what you do. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, thank you for all of that. I'm glad you wanted to have that opportunity to expand a little bit on what you'd said in previous interviews. So now there's a few things, quick questions, not necessarily quick, but some questions I want to ask. And one was based on an email chat I had with Dave Egan, who we've referenced a couple of times here, and that's the difference between the term restoration ecology and the term ecological restoration. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
I believe the term ecological restoration was coined by Bill Jordan, who was also interviewed earlier, and his colleague at the Arboretum at the time, Keith Wint, who I believe was the Arboretum Ranger when he worked at the Arboretum. But anyway, those two had a good working relationship and thought a lot about what was going on, and they were thinking about what was going on at the Arboretum, and it really had no name, certainly among Arboretum folks or elsewhere. So they coined the term ecological restoration, referring to returning or repairing a damaged ecosystem. In the early thinking, to an earlier state, pre-settlement, pre-European settlement. Now that notion is expanded, and we realize that going backwards in time is not possible. But anyway, the notion was that people were restoring the land in an ecological sense. So that was thought of as the doing, as the practice. The work I was doing, work my colleagues were doing, the work people at the Nature Conservancy and the prairie enthusiasts were doing, actual hands-on labor. I'm not sure when the term restoration ecology was first used, but that has come to mean the science, the study of this restoration business. So the conducting of experiments, the inquiry into well, I guess a good example would be probably what Curtis and Parch did back in the 40s when they were looking at prescribed fire. That was, we would think of that as restoration ecology. They were doing scientific research, trying to figure out why their expectations weren't being met. Mm-hmm. So as this field has expanded, these two terms are used interchangeably, but they also still refer to the science and academics and professors on the one hand, restoration ecology, and ecological restoration on the other, generally means practitioners, people who are doing the work. So this is, in some people's minds, has led to an unhealthy and sort of discriminatory way of thinking about this field. So there's the thinkers and then there's the doers. Mm-hmm. Sort of a typical academic university dichotomy. There are others of us who think that really, in practice, this restoration ecology is at its best as sort of a seamless enterprise between asking questions, doing some trial and error or controlled study work to figure out what's going on, putting those findings into practice, and then going back to the beginning and say, well, your findings work sort of okay, but there's still this, there's this little nagging question we have. Can we do some more inquiry to figure out how to make our burns more effective, or what's the best time to be burning, or that sort of thing. So, and we did quite a bit of that approach at the Arboretum once Joy Zettler came to the Arboretum. She is the Leopold Professor, and she calls it adaptive management, where you're consciously setting up whole site experiments to answer questions and then put those findings into practice. Does that make sense?
Yep, that does.
Okay.
It really does. Thank you for that. So a couple more things about the Arboretum. We'll sort of, just a couple more things and then sort of the final questions. In the email you sent when we were planning the follow-up interview, you mentioned an awards program that started as an idea in your mind and has become, I think, an annual thing. So I wonder if you would talk about sort of your role in that.
Oh, yeah. These are the Aldo Leopold Restoration Awards, which are sponsored by the Friends of the Arboretum and the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Every October, so they just had one in October of 2014. I'm not sure the number, maybe the 13th or 14th annual award. We'll have to check the exact number when it began, but I think we can trace that back to an idea or suggestion I had, which I brought up with my colleague Mark Leach at the time. He was the ecologist at the Arboretum. That we really needed, you know, a recognition or rewards program that would focus on those people who had some connection to the Arboretum and then went on in the larger world to contribute to the field of restoration ecology. And I was inspired by the annual awards program that the journalism school has. So they give a series of awards to the, you know, the student award, the Harold Nelson Award, the person who makes a lifetime career contribution. The person who, you know, has their first 10 years just take off like a skyrocket. Whole series of awards, maybe five or six in different categories, and all given to a journalism school alumni. And these people have gone on to, you know, make contributions to CNN and the New York Times and around the world. And Anthony Shadid, he was a Pulitzer Prize winner a couple times. Anyway, I was really impressed by that and suggested to, I believe, Sarah Minkoff at the Friends of the Arboretum that it would be nice if the Arboretum had such a thing to honor and recognize folks who were either a student or once worked at the Arboretum or were a professor and taught at the Arboretum, you know, some connection to the Arboretum. And Mark Leach and I sort of promoted this idea and met with the board of the Friends of the Arboretum, and I believe the next year they, you know, to explain our thinking, and then the next year they initiated the program. So I'll take some credit for that.
Okay, thank you for that. And so, just to clarify, you're thinking this last October was either the 13th or the 14th iteration, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we can check on that. Okay, so I think you talked about this in the interview that all three of you were involved in, the video mm-hmm, interview, mm-hmm. but I want to ask about, since you've retired, what sort of things have you done related to, I guess it would be ecological restoration. So if you want some space to talk about that.
Yeah. Just as I retired, a textbook in ecological restoration that I co-authored with professors in the landscape architecture department, John Harrington and Evelyn Howell, was published by Island Press. It's called Introduction to Restoration Ecology. And it was the first, or tied for first, textbook in restoration ecology. And we consciously called it restoration ecology because all three of us think of this field as sort of the seamless interplay and interaction between inquiry and testing and practice. So since then, since I've formally retired, I'm doing a lot of volunteer work. So I volunteer with City Madison Parks Department. I'm a member of their Habitat Stewardship Subcommittee of the Parks Committee. And we're a citizens group who advises on park actions in its conservation parks. I also volunteer with some neighborhood groups along the Southwest Bike Path. In the Dudgeon Monroe neighborhood and the Westmoreland neighborhood on prairie restorations, some of which are now old enough to be burned. So for the past few years, I've been on the burn crew for these neighborhood restorations. I've also been on prescribed burns with the Aldo Leopold Foundation up in Baraboo. I volunteer with the Prairie Enthusiasts on some of their restoration projects. So seed collecting, seed cleaning, brush clearing, those typical restoration activities. This spring of 2015, I'll be burning with the Nature Conservancy as a crew member. Let's see, what else? I think that's it.
So it sounds like a lot of it revolves around what you did at the Arboretum, specifically the prescribed burns.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And other kinds of restoration work, right? Mm-hmm. And I haven't been volunteering at the Arboretum yet. I think it's good to give those folks who succeeded me time and space to do their own thing without somebody coming in and looking over their shoulder. Excuse me.
So a couple of quick questions before we give you space at the end to talk about legacy. I neglected to ask, when you were here doing work, your school work, I'm always interested in spaces on campus, so
yeah.
When you were here, what sort of spaces did you use to study or to meet with colleagues and do group work, if any?
Steenbach Library.
Okay.
For academics. I mean, Steenbach Library is just... as you know, it's a fantastic resource. And the staff at the time, I'm sure the staff is still great, the staff at the time consisted of Jackie Lathrop. And who was the fellow who's gone on to become, or went on to become, the head of the library system?
Oh, Ken Frazier.
Ken Frazier, yeah, yeah. So Ken Frazier was... He was down at the reception desk or in collections. So that's where we hung out.
Okay. And then what spaces, if any? I know you didn't come here as an undergrad, so it's sort of, I think it's different as an undergrad or come here as a grad student, but were there places on campus or nearby that, you know, after studying or after a test that you might go get a beer or just chat about things that weren't related to work, per se?
Yeah, there's a couple. There's one little complex that we went to which no longer exists. They're on University Avenue, and it's the area now occupied by WID.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a whole row of little restaurants and bars and can't even remember any of their names, but it was, we were in the landscape architecture department in Ag Hall, so it was just an easy jaunt down to those places. And then the terrace, Union Terrace, of course.
Okay. Thank you for that. So the final question, and I think to an extent you answered at least part of it when you talked about prescribed burning at the Arboretum, mm-hmm, but I always like to ask a question about legacy. So a little bit, give you some space to talk about, if you want, about what mark you think you left on the Arboretum and sort of by association on campus.
Well, others will have to judge the legacy part, but the aspects that I'm proud of and they think I contributed in was, of course, the prescribed burn program. So we kept that going without break. We professionalized it in the sense that everyone who participated in a burn had to go to the basic training of prescribed burning, which was sponsored by the Nature Conservancy. S-100, S-130, S-160. Those were the standard courses that introduced you to what burning was all about. So all of our staff and volunteers took those courses. And when I came, it was just staff burning. So we had a permanent field staff of 6 or 7 or 8, depending on the season. In later years, then we could take on students. And in the early 2000s, many students came to us having had burn training or experience on burns with the Nature Conservancy or prairie enthusiasts. But I also pushed to get pure volunteers. And so I worked with Judy Kingsbury, the volunteer coordinator, and we crafted a volunteer training program and got approval from risk management on campus to allow us to use volunteers. And there are considerable liability insurance issues related to, as you can imagine, having people off the street out there playing with fire. So we had to assure risk management that that's not what it was. It wasn't people off the street playing with fire. It was trained people under supervision, knowing what they're doing. So that's expanded the Arboretum's ability to conduct burns, because as the Arboretum's activities expand and sometimes its staff shrinks, you may not have enough people to burn. So if you have students and or volunteers, that helps you fill the ranks. And I'm proud that, as I mentioned several times, we did all these burns, over 230, without property damage or personal injury. I guess another area that I think we made a contribution was bringing our management and especially pest plant control up to standards, where we were using proven techniques and proven herbicides, and as a result, we're able to remove buckthorn and honeysuckle, the two primary culprits from Winger Woods, Galistel Woods, Noe Woods, and so that was a significant achievement. And because it took hundreds and maybe thousands of people hours to do that over the course of 10 or 12 years.
Steve, is there anything else you want to say?
Well, the other thing I would just mention is that one of my mentors, which I maybe haven't stressed and should, it was Virginia Klein, who was the arboretum ecologist when I came in 1989. And we had a great working relationship, and she taught me most of what I know about ecology and management. And she was science-based. And the person who took that scientific approach to restoration another notch or two was Joy Zedler when she came on board in about 2000. And so working with Joy and incorporating research, well, incorporating this restoration ecology approach where we use scientific inquiry and curiosity and testing to improve practice and to advance knowledge, I think was a nice team effort. And I think those of us who were involved in that are quite happy with the results. I think just one example is the work that Joy did to understand the impacts of stormwater on reed canary grass and the impacts reed canary grass had on our plant communities. And the exploration we did of what management tools were available to sort of reduce that impact. And that was a nice example of an adaptive management restoration ecology approach that lasted several years. And just to sum up, I, you know, had a wonderful career there. I was privileged to work where Leopold and Curtis and Virginia Klein made their mark, and was honored to carry on the prescribed burning program and just worked with a wonderful bunch of colleagues over the years. It was a pleasure.
Well, Steve, I think this wraps it up. So this concludes the oral history with Steve Glass. Steve, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks. It's been a pleasure.